This was one of my favorite podcasts we've ever done. I had my friend John Acuff on. If you don't know who he is an author who has written 7 books, 2-time New York Times bestseller. He was number 1 on the Wall Street Journal. He's a top 100 leadership speaker. And we talked about things that I think are going to really help you guys out in your self-development. We talked about how to set goals properly, how you guys can avoid the, you know, pitfalls of overthinking. We talked about how you can start turning your ideas into money. And also, we talked about how he has turned his ideas into a public speaking career that is going to make him 7 figures a year. So make sure you guys stay to the end. Now, let's jump into it.
Are you looking to grow your real estate investing business? My company, Future Flipper, can help. We've taught hundreds of people all over the country how to flip, wholesale, and buy rental properties. And it doesn't matter where you're at in your investing journey. Whether you're trying to get your first deal or scale your company, Future Flipper can help. We have courses, coaching, and events for all levels of investors. So if you want to take the next step, go to futureflipper.com and book a free consultation to see how we can best help you. Once again, that's futureflipper.com. If you've ever wanted to invest with me on my real estate deals, it's now possible. At Pineda Capital, we're purchasing value-add real estate all across the country. This includes multifamily, commercial, and land development. The best part is, with my network, social media presence, and marketing strategies, we're able to get the very best deals that others don't have access to. You can join in with me on those deals if you're an accredited investor. If you want to learn more, head over to PinedaCapital.com to see our current opportunities. Once again, that's PinedaCapital.com.
Welcome to the Ryan Pineda Show, where our mission is to invest.
I only expect to make money in things that I understand.
Innovate.
It's about believing in the future and thinking that the future will be better than the past.
And inspire.
I am much more likely to hit my goal just due to putting it out there.
Now rocking with the best.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Ryan Pineda Show. Today, I've got somebody that I've been talking to for quite a while, but we finally have met in person. He has written 7 books, 2 of which are New York Times bestsellers, 1 of which was number 1 on the Wall Street Journal. He's also a top 100 leadership speaker. Got none other than my good friend, John Acuff. What up, dude?
It's great to finally meet you live. We've done this virtually for about a year now, so it's fun to know you actually aren't catfishing me.
I know.
You're a real person in a real town.
I'm here, right here in Vegas, and the way John and I met was pretty cool. I talk a lot about faith in this podcast, and him and I are part of a men's Bible study prayer group together, and it's just been cool getting to know you and some of the other guys on that call. You know, it's entrepreneur based. These guys are all over the country, and it's just cool hearing like from other Christian entrepreneurs, kind of some of the struggles and different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think the real thing with entrepreneurs is you can get isolated instantly.
Yeah,
it's you're already kind of unique to go against the flow, and then you get isolated in your town, and you think I'm the only one doing that. And so to have community, whether that's virtual, whether that's real, I think is beneficial.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So, you know, there's a few things before this podcast we were talking about. What kind of message do we want the people to hear? Mm-hmm. And you've written many books. Some are on goal setting. Some are your most recent one, Soundtracks, is on how to stop overthinking, mm-hmm. which, you know, we can dive into. I think it's a great topic. The one I personally was interested in when you told me was that, you know, public speaking, you know, you're getting paid over $30,000 to go speak for an hour to these companies and different things. And I'm like, man, how do I get in on that? So we're going to talk about all these things, man.
Yeah, we've got a lot to cover. I'm excited to be here, and I think we're going to dig into any question you have. I think we're going to have some fun answers.
All right, cool. So let's just jump right into it, dude. How the heck did you get to where you're at today as an author and public speaker? Like, did you want to be an author? How did that develop?
I didn't know it was a thing. I was in corporate marketing. I think everyone, whether they go to college or not, anyone in their early 20s should take a copywriting course, because you're going to need to know how to clearly communicate a sticky idea, whether it's in a meeting, whether it's in an email. So I was in corporate marketing. I started a blog. The blog went kind of viral. And I got a publishing deal out of that. And the publishing deal was for $30,000. And all these people started to come up to me and go, are you going to move to Mexico now? Are you going to retire? And it was $13,000 after agent fees and taxes. And no one who wins a $13,000 lottery has friends go, I guess it's it. You're moving now. Yeah. And so, but it was a small start. And I had somebody say to me out of the blue, emailed and said, hey, will you come speak at our event? And I didn't know that you got paid for that. I didn't know that was an industry. I didn't even know how to do that. All I had was a single thought that said, I think I can be a public speaker. But what I teach people with mindset is your thoughts turn into actions, turn into results. So that first email is what I turned into a full-time career.
So what year was this?
This was in 2008.
So the market already crashed and everything?
Yep. Yeah. Market crashed. I had a full-time job, 2 kids under the age of 3. I had a beautiful wife. I had side hustle gigs. I was writing jingles for laser hair removal commercials. I had a bunch going on, which is why when people say, I'm really, really busy, I go, I know that's why you have to be selfish at 5 a.m. You know who wasn't bothering me at 5 a.m.? My full-time job. My kids necessarily weren't up every morning. And so I just figured out, okay, if this is going to happen, I have to make it happen. How do I be selfish at 5 a.m.? Work on my goals when the rest of the world is asleep.
I love that, dude. You know, on this podcast, I've talked a ton about my morning routine. Mm-hmm. And I talk about how it's like a non-negotiable for me. Like, I've got to get in my time every single morning. And my wife knows how important it is to me. Mm-hmm. And she knows that, you know, I quote unquote need to be selfish with it, yep. Right? Because once I go out for the day, you know, I'm out in the world, man. Yep. Whatever happens, happens. And, you know, later on when I get done from work, I got to go hang with my family. That's their time. And, you know, really the only time I get is that early morning time.
Well, there's two slingshot moments in every day. There's the morning and the night. So the first thing you do in the morning and the last thing you do at night, those are slingshots. One slingshots you into the day, one slingshots you into your dreams. And so both of those moments matter. And so if you'll protect them and if you're deliberate about them, you can really set yourself up.
I've never thought about the slingshot moment after, you know, before sleep. Like, to me, it makes sense, right? Do something in the morning and it's going to impact you. Like, I know when I spend my quiet time with God, I feel so much better the rest of the day. I act differently than how I would act had I not did that.
You treat people differently.
I treat people differently. Mm-hmm. I'm more aware. When I work out in the morning, I feel way better throughout the day. Like, I get that. But I've never thought about my nighttime routine.
Yeah, so Jewish scholars used to talk about your day starts the night before. So you're setting yourself up. The problem is a lot of people will segment their lives. So they won't connect morning them to night them. So they'll go, oh, I'm so frustrated. It's so hard to get up in the morning. It's because night you screwed you. The decisions you made the night before impact how you're able to start the morning. So the decisions you make matter right before bed. You go, okay, I'm going to get some sleep. I'm going to eat certain things. I'm going to read certain things so that I'm setting myself up for success tomorrow. I always tell people you need to forgive your former self. You need to enjoy your current self and prepare your future self. Mm. And so that's part of that process is going, okay, if I want tomorrow morning to be easier, better, more potential, what do I do tonight to set myself up?
Right. So going, getting your sleep, not eating late, not...
Well, and putting thoughts. If you have a problem you're working on, throw it into your mind. Like, throw it in there and go, okay, subconsciously, I want to think about this. It's kind of like a rock tumbler. You want a shiny rock, you throw it into a rock tumbler. It's going to take some time. So right before bed, if you've got a challenge you've been having, go, okay, what's this thing? Okay, brain, I did my best today. What do I want to think about? Okay, there's a question I have. There's a reason that people have great ideas in the shower. It's the only time they're left to be bored. And so you go, okay, I'm going to think about this idea right before I go to bed, knowing that as I sleep, I'm going to give myself a chance to think about this and work on this. And it's amazing how often the next day, the next afternoon, you go, wait a second, I just had this bit of insight. And it's something you can be deliberate about. Why wait for a eureka moment? It's way better to plan them and be deliberate about them.
I love that. Yeah, I can tell you, it makes complete sense. I've never, like, I've always instinctively been like, hey, I got to get good sleep, so I'm ready to go tomorrow. But, you know, when you put it that way, it's like, yeah, your next day is severely impacted by the night before. And if you don't take it seriously, it's hard to, you know, have a great day.
Well, and you can't complain the next morning. You set yourself up. There's not a separate person that did that. Like, night Ryan set up morning Ryan. So there's always a connection. And I think that people tend to have a hard time connecting those two parts of their day.
Yeah, no, I love that. So another thing you mentioned was copywriting classes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's funny, man, because I went to college. I got an economics degree, but I was really just going to play baseball. Mm-hmm. And eventually, as I got into business, I started learning about, you know, marketing and getting people to buy your products. And, you know, I wrote my book, didn't know what I was doing. Nobody paid me 30 grand to do it either.
Sure.
I just was like, I'm just going to write a book. No writing experience or copywriting. And it ended up doing great. We sold thousands of copies. And I have literally, like, it's funny, after somebody read it and they're like, yeah, you know, if you want to write another one, you can use us as a ghostwriter. They're like, you need to add more stories and like things to, because mine was just, my personality is, here's the facts.
Yeah.
Here's how you do it. Let's get to the
boom,
point.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. And it's funny because some people are like, I like it because there's no fluff.
Yeah.
And then there are others where I know had I add, you know, thrown in relevant stories, sure, it would help them to really understand it better. Mm-hmm. But as I got into business, I started learning what copywriting was. I'd never heard of it. I'm like, copywriting? It's like the thing at the bottom of a trademark.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? Mm-hmm. But you learn it's just like essentially persuasion.
Yeah.
How do you get people to, you know, do what you want them to do? Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about that. Why is it important?
So my job, I consider my job to be a handle maker. I put handles on ideas. We have enough ideas. There's too many ideas. We don't have handles on them to pick them up and take them into our lives. So what I do with copywriting is I put handles on ideas so that you can say, okay, I'm going to remember that. My book soundtracks. If I had said your inner voices, it would have sold tremendously less copies because people would self-select and go, voices, I don't know about that. Soundtracks, when you go, when you hear a soundtrack, it changes the whole scene in a movie. And that's what a repetitive thought is. Your soundtracks that you listen to about yourself, about your life, about your boss, change a scene. So that's a sticky word versus going inner voices. Inner voices would have put it in a much narrower category. But soundtracks, everybody goes, I've heard a soundtrack, that makes sense to me. So that's what I mean by copywriting, is going, how do I make this sticky? How do I make it clear? How do I take this big complex thing and summarize it? So another one, people will say to me, John, how do you be fearless? Like, I want to be fearless. And I always say, one, you can't. That's just not true. Like, you will always have fear. And if you don't have fear, it means you've stopped growing. At every new level you try something bigger, there should be a new level of fear. First time I spoke to 10 people, I had 10-person fear, but I worked on it. I got over it. Second time, 100-person fear. Third time, 1,000-person fear. I spoke to 8,000 people last week, 8,000-person fear. There was always fear. So what I'll say copywriting-wise is fear gets a voice, not a vote. Fear gets a voice, not a vote. It gets a voice. I'm going to hear it. I'm going to learn from it. If I shut fear off, I don't get to learn from it, but it doesn't get a vote. It doesn't get to sit at the head of my table and say, you don't get to do that. Ryan's not expanding that. Ryan's not going to do that. So I can tell somebody 10 pages of fear, or I can give them an easy soundtrack to remember, something sticky, and say, fear gets a voice, not a vote. So that's what copywriting is. It gives your idea a chance to go. And then I'll give all your listeners a $1 million book titling idea, because according to the New York Times, 81% of Americans want to write a book. One of the most popular goals in the country. You know how many do every year? 1%. 81% say they want to, 1% do. Why does that happen? It happens for a variety of reasons. But if anybody wants to write a book, here's a $1 million titling lesson. You fix the problem. You sell the problem. You fix. You sell the solution. You fix the problem. What do I mean by that? I named a book Do Over. I had a book named Do Over. Loved the title. Thought it was positive. Rise from the ashes. It's a great chance for you to start again. People did not like that title. The average American, especially Americans, don't want to self-identify with failure.
Right.
They see a book at the airport, they go, that's not for me. They also don't want to give a book about failure to somebody else. No husband has ever read a book from their wife that goes, I read a book, yeah. I heard about a book about blind rage. It reminded me of you, just going to put it on the nightstand. So I changed the subtitle, we changed everything. It didn't sell as well. The next book that came out, Finish, our initial subtitle was Stop Making Perfect the Enemy of Done. Stop. Enemy, too negative. We changed the subtitle to Give Yourself the Gift of Done, sold twice as many books. So don't learn. That lesson cost me $1 million to learn. So I meet people all the time. They'll say, I'm going to write this book. It's about divorce. And I'm going to title the book, How to Avoid a Terrible Divorce. No, nobody wants that. Nobody wants, they don't want to put that on their desk. They don't want to say,
yeah.
Like, so if you'll figure out, okay, I'm going to fix the problem inside the book, I'm going to sell the solution outside the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It should be how to, you know, have a happy marriage, whatever, right?
How to have the best marriage you've ever dreamed of.
Right, right. So that's something that I've totally learned from social media and creating content and YouTube is like, man, you have to, like, at the end of the day, right? You're not changing the content in the book.
No.
The book is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. But how you package it determines whether or not it gets seen or read.
And you have to know, here's the thing people have to know. The job of the title isn't to explain the whole book. The job of the title is to get you to read the subtitle. The job of the subtitle is to get you to flip it over and look at the back. The job of the back is to get you to open it up and read the flap. The job of the flap is to get you to read the first page of the first chapter. So what happens is, whether you're doing YouTube, podcast, any content you're creating, people over-explain. And they go, I got to have a YouTube title that explains the entire thing. Yeah. I got to have a... And you don't. All you have to do is walk them down the next part of the ladder.
Right.
And that's what good copywriting does. But a lot of people make that mistake, and you see these ideas where they jammed 42 different ideas into one, and it stops people right away before they've even started.
Yeah, no, 100% is true. And like when I started, when I wrote my book, it was in 2018, I read a book called Published by Chandler Bolt. And he basically said, hey, you know, when people are looking at new books, right? If you're a no-name author, first thing they're going to look at is the cover. Like, does the cover catch their eye? And it made sense to me because when I look at YouTube videos and what I'm going to watch, the first thing I look at is the thumbnail.
Yep.
I'm like, does the thumbnail catch my eye? And so it works like, okay, you got cover. All right, that looks visually nice. And so, like, if you look at my book's over there, by the way, it's blue and orange. It's bright. It's like, oh, wow, what is that? Then you read the title, like you said, which same thing on YouTube, it's the title. You're like, okay, you know, I'll watch this video. Yep. And, you know, whatever. Your content has to be good, first and foremost. But, like, when you watch one of my videos, you know, really the goal is to not just watch the video, but to take you to the next step, like you said. The next step is either, hey, you're going to subscribe to my channel and continue to watch, and that's great. Or maybe you're going to go check out one of my businesses or my products, and that's great too. But it all starts with that first, you know, essential copywriting and drawing them into the content.
How you create the idea. And the reason why people don't write books, people don't flip houses, people don't start podcasts, anybody watching this right now that has a goal that's not going to do it, because 92% of all New Year's resolutions fail, according to the University of Scranton. You have a greater shot at getting into Juilliard to become a professional ballerina, which is an 8.6% chance, than you do at finishing a goal. Part of the reason that happens is we announce goals and we don't change our actions. So we say things like, I'm writing a book. When you say that at a dinner party, people pre-congratulate you. They go, good for you, Ryan. When you say, I'm going to start flipping houses, they go, oh, wow, I've always thought about that myself. You're so brave to do that. You haven't done a single thing. You're already getting pre-congratulated, and your body releases dopamine. And it's not a ton, but it's enough dopamine that you never actually flip a house. You never actually write the book. You sit there and go, I did do something. You're right. Training for a marathon, same thing. So instead of announcing your goal, ask for accountability. If you say to a friend, instead of going, I'm writing a book, I'm flipping a house, hey, next week, will you text me and ask me if I did that course? Will you text me and ask me if I, you know, followed up on that? Will you ask me if I wrote three times? Will you just shoot me a short text? Accountability is so much more valuable than announcements. And they've been studying that since the 30s. That's not something new. So there's all these things that you go, how come I don't finish goals? There's all this science. There's all these practical things you can do that the majority of people online don't do.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, dude. I, you know, whenever I have a goal or I'm going to do something new, I really never announce it. Like, I typically just go out behind the scenes and start doing it. And when it's done, then I announce it. And I'm like, yo,
time to
just
celebrate.
Started this new company. You know, here it is. Boom, boom, boom. People never knew I was writing a book. It was just like, hey, guys, did you know I just released this book?
Yep.
Go buy it. So it's like, I'm with you. And for me, the reason I've always been that way is like, I don't ever want to, I guess, be a failure.
Yeah.
So it's just like, hey, I'm going to write this book, and then I never do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, that guy, he always says all this crap and never does
it. And never actually follows through.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I know one of your books, which book was on writing goals?
Finish was about how to finish goals.
Yeah. Yep. So what are some other things you see with goals that people just
don't realize? Overestimate. It's called planning fallacy. It's the belief that you can get more done in less time. So they have these crates. They'll say to me, John, I'm going to start running. I'll go, that's great. They'll go, yeah, I'm going to run a marathon. And I'll say, have you ever done a half marathon or a 10K or a 5K, even just a K? And they go, no, I heard
an
Eminem song.
You ran a mile.
Exactly. They go, I heard an Eminem song, Mom Spaghetti, like, oh, I'm doing it. I'm doing Kona. I'm going to do the Ironman. And it's not sustainable, and it crashes before it even starts. So figuring out how to make sustainable change and continue to add to your goal, even as you have a big goal. Have a big, crazy goal, but you have to have some small steps along the way.
Yeah, the milestones.
Exactly. And so that's a big thing. The other thing that we did a big study. We studied 900 people for 6 months as they worked on goals. And one of the things that came up was that if you'll add fun to your goal, you're more successful. you raise your satisfaction by 31% and your performance by 46%. And that was surprising because most people think a goal has to be difficult or miserable to count. So you meet people all the time, you say, what are your five words you think of when you think of a goal? They say hustle, grind, willpower, persistence, like struggle. They never go joy, laughter, engagement, fulfillment. And so we studied and said, okay, add a little bit of fun. And when you add fun, you'll work harder, you'll work longer. And it's not have fun, it's make it fun. You have to be deliberate. There's so much garbage motivational stuff that says, like, just follow your heart, follow your passion. And what happens is the minute it doesn't feel a certain way, you think it's the wrong thing and you quit. I heard another speaker say, if you don't love 90% of what it takes to be in your business, you're in the wrong business. 90% in a 40-hour work week. That means 36 hours feel like running in a field with a ribbon, and there's only 4 hours that are hard. Like, I was on a delayed flight to Las Vegas yesterday. 6 hours in LAX. There's not a person on the planet that's like, this is amazing. I love LAX in this tiny little corner and like not know if I'm going to get there. But I would trade all those hours for the 1 hour I get to be on stage. And so it's not that every part of your goal is going to be fun. It's that you deliberately go, these things are challenging. How do I add some forms of motivation that make them fun? And the two forms scientists study are reward and fear, or another way to say it is approach and avoidance. If I do these three things, I approach this reward. Some people are motivated by the reward. Other people say, okay, if I do these three things, I avoid this negative consequence. Mm. Financial planners, a good financial planner, for instance, knows, okay, Ryan is a reward-focused person, so I'm going to paint a picture of what it'll be if he does the work. Ryan, if you do the work, you can have this amazing thing. And here's, if I know your consequence, I say the reverse. I go, dude, if you don't do it, your kids won't be able to go to college. Like, you'll have to work until the day you die. Like, here's this negative thing. And so you as an individual have to go, in order for me to get things done, do I need to add a little bit of reward, personal rewards along the way, or some consequences along the way that keep me inspired?
Do you think people are usually more reward-focused or consequent-focused?
I think it's usually a mix. I mean, for myself, like, I was having a hard time finishing writing a book. And so I said, when I finish this manuscript, I get to buy myself a pair of ski boots. If you've never skied, renting ski boots is like renting prisons for your feet. It's the worst. And so I said, when I turn in the manuscript, I get to buy them. I could have bought them that day, but I needed a reward on the finish line that would pull me toward it. Right. There's other things like, I practice and prepare for public speaking events, not for the reward or the applause, because I don't want to bomb. I've seen speakers bomb. And my worst nightmare is I've got an hour and I'm done in 5 minutes. And it's just like, hey, how about life, huh? Like, queso's crazy. Like, so I think it's a mix of both. But every leader, if there's anybody watching this and they manage people, has had the moment where you try to motivate somebody with the wrong form of motivation. And it's terrible. So I worked with a woman once and they gave us orange iPod shuffles as a prize at this company. And she goes, ugh, I hate the color. And at first I thought, oh, she's so entitled. But then I realized, no, she's just not reward focused. They could have given her 50 rewards, bonuses, everything.
Wouldn't matter.
Didn't move the needle. There's other people though, if they're not consequence based, you sit them down and go, dude, we got to get this together. We're going to have a hard conversation. If they're not encouraged by consequences, even on the day they've been fired, they walk out like, pretty good day. And you're like, it wasn't. Like, I wanted to keep you. And so you have to figure it out for yourself. And then it gets powerful when you figure it out for your team members, the people you work with.
Yeah. While you were saying that, I was literally thinking about my employees because, you know, when I'm trying to motivate them, I think about that. And I've never realized there were two ways to motivate people. Mm-hmm. I just naturally was like, yeah, this person, if I can show them the big picture of what it looks like, they're going to be hyped and they're going to go. And this person, you know, if I can like show them the consequence of like, dude, if you keep this up, this ain't going to be good, dude. Yeah. They're going to go really hard. Yeah. And for me personally, you know, that's why I asked, are people more rewards focused or consequence focused? I'm like 100% rewards. Mm. I rarely think about the downside or the negativity. I'm just like, dude, everything. Tell me how wait this could be. Okay. I'm in. Let's go.
Totally.
Because I'm like, I'm never going to fail. Like, that's just my mindset.
Sure.
Even though I failed in many things.
Sure.
I don't ever think about like, oh man, if I fail, this is what happens. Or I'm like, oh man, I need to go do this because this bad thing will happen if I don't. I'm just always like, dude, tell me about the upside. What can we do?
Yeah. What's the future look like? And what's interesting, you just get creative with it. Like a consequence-based one, there's a guy named David Hooper in Nashville, and he has a business coach, and his business coach knew he was consequence-based. So he said, give me 3 signed checks. And every time you miss one of your goals, I'm going to send the politician you hate the most some of your money. And that motivated him on a consequence level. The idea of this politician is going to do terrible things with my money, this person that I, and so it was a consequence based. So it's, you know, it's interesting, but for you, for anybody else who's a leader, the way you figure out how somebody's motivated is you interview them about a win. You say to them, tell me about a time it went really well for you on a project. What was present? And that, and you listen to them talk about it. Cause often they'll go, oh wow, like we had team meetings once a week. Okay. They need some visibility. Maybe they're visibility motivated. Okay. And I, you know, we had check-ins and I got to present and I got, you know, rewards, and you go, okay. Cause the average person doesn't take forward their wins enough. So we say in our culture, like failure is the best way to learn. Winning is a great way to learn too. It's just we usually move beyond it so fast. I'd rather, if you gave me an option, fail and learn or win and learn, I'm picking win and learn every time. Yeah. But what happens is I'll meet people that'll go, John, I'm having a hard time losing weight. And I'll go, well, tell me about a time you won in the past. And they'll go, well, I got my finances together and it was great. And I go, well, what made that easier? And they go, well, we're in a small group and we did all these things. And I'll go, well, how many of those tools are present in the weight loss goal? And usually the answer is zero. Yeah. So you go, how from that win? People have worked at other companies that work here. And you go, tell me about a win that worked. And they're going to go, oh, we did these five things. And they're going to light up. And then your job as a leader is to go, okay, there's only one of those five things present right now. If I add some of those, we're going to blow up.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, man. So that I'm going to for sure use that in my business. And it's really good to just be aware of those things, especially for yourself, but also for your coworkers, for your team, your wife, your kids.
If you have two kids, you know kids are different. Yeah. Like kids are differently motivated. You only need to have two kids to realize they come to this planet with brains that are different, unique. The stresses are unique. I have a senior daughter in high school and a sophomore daughter in high school, and they were both raised in the same house, and their motivation systems are the opposite.
Yeah.
And so I need to figure out, as a dad, as a, you know, as a parent, what does that look like? How do I encourage them?
Yeah, for sure. Like my sister, we're 4 years apart. She's literally like my right-hand person in my business. And our reward system is drastically different, mm-hmm. where it's like, for me, like I said, it's all rewards. Like, hey, tell me, like, let's do the upside. Like, okay, I'm doing it. For her, she does operate more on fear. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh man, like if I don't do this, what happens to this? Yeah. But it's good to counterbalance me, because if we're both just like,
no, yeah.
Everything's a win. Let's go, baby.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to jump off some cliffs together.
Yeah.
And think this is going to end well. That's good. That's good.
So yeah, I want to talk about soundtracks and why so many people struggle with overthinking. But before we do that, let's hear a quick word from our sponsor. Have you ever wanted to invest in real estate, but you didn't have the time to find deals yourself? That's where Fundrise comes in. Fundrise is a crowdfunding platform that has transacted over $5 billion in real estate and has over 150,000 active investors. While many funds, like my own, require accredited investors, Fundrise allows anyone to invest with as little as $500. If you'd like to learn more, check out fundrise.com. Once again, that's fundrise.com. Are you looking to find off-market real estate deals? One of the best tools my team uses is Batch Leads. With Batch Leads, you're able to pull data, manage lists, and send text messages. On top of that, you can get nationwide access to the MLS to get pictures and comps. My team has used Batch Leads to get some of our best deals, so I know it works. If you want to start today, you can get half off your first month by going to batchleads.io and using the promo code Ryan. Once again, that's batchleads.io, promo code Ryan, for half off your first month. Now, back to the show. So after I met you, I read Soundtracks, and it was a very good book about overthinking, something that I think a lot of people struggle with, whether they know it or not. Mm-hmm. And I think it causes indecisiveness.
Yep.
And you mentioned a lot of great things in that book, but I mean, if you could sum it up, what are some ways that people can, you know, cure this overthinking and this indecisiveness and everything?
Well, so I use the phrase soundtrack to describe repetitive thoughts. So if you want to understand if you have what I'd call a broken soundtrack, here's a 30-second activity you can do. Everyone listening, watching, whatever, can do this. Write down a goal. Write down a desire. Write down a hope. It could be, I want to start a podcast. I want to flip a house. I want to ask somebody out. I want to date my spouse again. It can be anything. And then listen to the first thoughts that come next. Listen to your reaction, because every reaction is an education. If the first thing you think next is you're too old for that, you've missed your chance, you don't have good ideas, somebody smarter has already done that, that's the wrong market for that. If you don't hear positive thoughts after, you probably have a broken soundtrack and you need to do something with that. And there's three questions you always ask a broken soundtrack. Number one, is it true? Is the thing I'm telling myself about myself, is the thing I'm telling myself about this opportunity, is it true? The second question is it helpful? When I tell myself that over and over again, does it push me forward or pull me back? Because some things are true, but they're not helpful. The third is it kind? If I said it to a friend, would they still want to be my friend? And if you'll ask those three questions and you can't say yes to all of them, it's probably a broken soundtrack and it's something that you need to retire.
Yeah, I love that, man. You know, it's funny. I think when I was playing baseball, I would think a lot, because if you just think about the sport of baseball in general, you're literally doing nothing like 90% of the time. I'm out on the field. I might see the ball once all game for the, you know, hour and a half I'm out on defense. And so you're just thinking the whole time. And then when you're hitting, you know, you're up to bat four times a game. The other times just sitting in the dugout, just chilling, thinking, talking to people. And then when you're up to bat, you got time in between each pitch to think and like, what's this guy going to throw me? Oh man, I look so stupid that last swing. Yeah. I look dumb that
last
swing.
Have I seen this pitcher before? What happened last
time? Yeah. So I remember in my career, overthinking was something that really harmed me. And I think, I mean, who's to say? Like, I, you know, I got as far as I did, which is more than most, but I do believe that I mentally was not strong enough. Like, I think I had the talent to do it. You know, I was, you know, a strong guy, pretty fast, could do a bunch of things, great hand-eye coordination, you know, attributes. But it's like, why did I not make it? And when I look back at my career, I'm like, yeah, I think I wasn't mentally strong enough, because right or wrong, like being somewhat of a smart guy who thinks a lot, especially, it served me well in business because I've gotten so many ideas and I'm always thinking of ways to improve. But me thinking about improving so much in baseball, I think harmed me in the games themselves.
Well, part of the problem is we're not taught to think. The average person doesn't even know they can control their thoughts. We say things like, she got carried away by her thoughts, or he got lost in his thoughts. Most people think a thought is something you have, not something you hone. Even my most type A friends who lay out their clothes the night before because it means they'll go to the gym, they don't pick their thoughts ahead of time. Very rarely do I meet people that go, next Thursday I got a big negotiation and the last one went kind of south, so I don't want to walk in with clenched hands on this one because it'll ruin the deal right from the get-go. So I'm going to listen to these soundtracks. Here's the thoughts that I want playing on loop when I go into that meeting. I mean, for me, I have a note card in front of my laptop that says, ask for more. Ask for more. That's not sexy. That's not hooky. But I needed a reminder because I found myself undervaluing my work. And I needed a physical reminder of, hey, wait a second. Ask for more. Another one I have, it says, people are trying to give me money. People are trying to give me money. Because again, I got stuck with this. Okay, what's going to go on in this? And old deals that fell through were leaving a residue. And there was broken soundtracks that were making me walk into negotiations with clenched fists. And it's not fun to do business with people who have clenched fists.
Right.
And so I couldn't just go, I hope my thoughts show up and they're good. No, thoughts come by two ways, choice or chance. So great performers, and who's to know about your baseball? But part of the problem is we're not taught how to think. There's not, you know, nobody takes a thinking class in eighth grade and goes, hey, your thoughts turn into your actions, turn into your results. Most people overfocus on their action and they white knuckle the actions, and you never change the underlying thoughts that are driving all of it.
Right.
So that's part of the problem. And you're not unique in that you didn't know, like whether or not you were mentally strong enough, I can't say, but I do know that you didn't have a how to think about performance class in the eighth grade or the ninth grade or the 10th grade that said, Ryan, here's how to control your thoughts so they turn into the kind of actions you want.
Right. Yeah. And I can tell you in baseball, I'd have those bad soundtracks. If I make an error, I'm like, oh, great. Hope I don't make an error on this next, you know, ball hit to me or I strike out. Oh man, this dude, he got me last time. Like, man, I hope
he's always going to get me.
Yeah, and so it's easy to get those negative soundtracks because baseball is a hard game.
yeah.
It's not like...
Well, the yips. It's a game where there's actually mental stuff that we talk about. Like,
yeah,
you know,
and I've gone through it before. Yeah. So, like, I know exactly how strong the mind is. And, like, I look at my life now, and it's like, okay, business has been great. You know, the ideas and the thinking has gotten me to new levels that, you know, other people couldn't have gotten to. And I'm just like, man, am I mentally stronger today because I'm aware of how powerful my thoughts are? Or, you know, and does that come with experience? Mm-hmm. You know, is this something that over time get stronger?
I think it comes with reps like anything else, but I also think it comes with age. I think you start to see, and you do experiments. Like, you're constantly doing experiments where you're going, okay, when I motivate this employee this way, this was the reaction. Oh, okay, I need to try that again. Yeah. I need to iterate. Like, you're paying attention. Self-awareness is a superpower. Like, if you can be self-aware and go, oh, when this happened, this is how I felt, this is how I reacted. Is that the reaction I want? If it's not, let me figure out a different reaction. Is this the reaction that led to the best decision? If it's not, let me figure that out. So a lot of people that are moving either so fast or they're so distracted. The average American watches 34 hours of TV a week. 34 hours, according to Nielsen. That's almost a 40-hour work week. So you have to know that, okay, if you're engaged in so much media, you're not being self-aware. You're being distracted,
right,
but you're not learning about yourself and learning what works best for you. So I think a big part of it for you and business is going, okay, this worked, but I bet it could work even better if I do it this way next time, or this worked, and let me pay attention, let me learn from this, let me be self-aware. So I think a lot of it is developing self-awareness over time.
Yeah, and I for sure, as I've gone along, have understood myself far better, and I think it goes back to that morning routine of that time alone and reflecting and really thinking about...
And deciding once. You know. Decide as few times as possible. You don't decide to do the morning thing every morning, because every time you decide, you open up a chance for you to talk yourself out of doing it.
I just do it.
You just do it.
Yeah.
You decided once 10 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever, versus going, am I going to do it today? Because if
it's
you
not
leave...
even an option.
It's not an option. You already decided.
Yeah. And I agree with that. The one thing that I'm very grateful baseball did with decision-making is that... once the game does happen and the ball is released, my thoughts go away.
Yeah.
Like, I am just reacting to whatever happens as a hitter or a fielder or whatever. And when it's come to business, I've reacted very quickly anytime I've really done anything. I can say for sure I've never been indecisive. Like, you know, somebody has a great idea, I'm like, let's do it. It feels good. Like, let's go. Or, you know, somebody, you know, offers me a deal. It's like, eh, I'm looking at it. Yeah, let's do the deal. Where people, other people are like, oh, well, you know, what could go wrong? You know, this or that. It's like, dude, good deals don't last.
Well, and that part of that is the prep, though. Like, your baseball, when the baseball's in the release, it's the wrong time to get better at hitting a baseball.
Yeah.
Like, you've done all the work. So you are reacting quickly, but I know you because you're also doing the research. You're also ingesting trends. You're also doing all this work so that when the deal is there, you don't then have to go, like, it's muscle, some degree of muscle
memory.
My
mind is processing it. It already knows.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, like, some of that is, same with me with speaking. If I'm doing an event and something unique happens, say somebody's phone rings or say, you know, a stage prop falls, I don't have to go, oh no, what do I do in this moment? I'm already in motion. Like, I've done all the work ahead of time to make sure that that happens the way I want it to happen. And I react quickly. But a lot of that is all the reps I've done.
Yeah. And experience. You've seen it already. You've been distracted. You're like, yeah, I mean, I've whatever. Yeah. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I know, okay, if they, like, something goes wrong with the tech and the slides aren't there and I'm in front of 10,000 people. The other day that happened, 8,000 people, the slides didn't work. And so that wasn't my first time that slides haven't worked. And so, like, 10 years ago in my career, I might have broken out into a cold sweat and been like, oh, no, hey, can somebody, you know, and then I might have, you know, just continued to fumble. This time I just rolled with it. And it was a quick reaction, but it was a quick reaction trained in the same way that with baseball, you took 1,000 swings before the four in a game.
So I guess essentially your preparation is going to make your reactions and decisions that much quicker.
Well, and if you've, you know, for me, that's the, so the way you deal with overthinking is three things. You retire broken soundtracks, you replace them with new ones, because you're going to think, you might as well just think good thoughts. And the third thing is you repeat them. You repeat them so often, they become as automatic as the old ones. The problem is the way people are wired is people go, John, you know, this exercise program isn't working. I go, how long have you done it? I go, 10 days. I go, how long did it take you to gain the weight? They'll say 10 years. And I go, you gave the problem 10 years to develop and the solution 10 days. That's so unkind to the solution.
Yeah.
Same with overthinking. They'll go, my new thoughts aren't working yet. And I'll go, well, how long have you thought that you don't deserve to, you know, write a book? And they'll go, 10 years.
Right.
And I go, well, how long have you been trying? They'll say 10 days. So you have to repeat those new soundtracks until you actually start to believe them.
Right.
And you know, you asked how powerful thoughts are. The best research study, in my opinion, on that was at NYU. They brought two groups of college students in. They said, hey, we want you to make sentences out of these words. Gave them a bunch of words. Second group said the same thing, but in their group were words hidden related to being old, where it's like old, retired, slow, even Florida, bald. And so they make these sentences. They say, hey, the second part of the test is down the hall. Please walk down the hall. And that was where the real test was. They secretly timed how long it took the students to walk down the hall. And the students who had just read the words related to being old physically walk slower. Just reading words about being old made them act old. So when people go, do our thoughts matter? 1,000%.
Yeah.
And so if you're deliberate and actually feed yourself good thoughts, there's nothing you can't do.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, man. It's kind of like the Napoleon Hill thing, just think and grow rich. Like everything starts with, you know, what you're thinking. And I know for, you know, before we jumped on this podcast, you're talking about kind of your next business being more along the lines of helping people do personal brands and helping them, you know, take their ideas and start monetizing them, which is kind of like what we're talking about here.
Yep.
So how do people do that? People have a million ideas. How do they start making money off of these things?
Totally. There's three things that every best-selling idea has in common, whether it's a new business, whether it's a book, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a speech. The first thing is it has a personal connection. You're personally connected to the idea because you're going to talk about it for years, and you can tell when someone's not personally connected. Second thing is there's a need. People actually need it. So that can be people in your neighborhood have mentioned something, people in your social channels, clients you've heard. The third thing is there's a spot for you in the marketplace that you go to the market and you test it. So for instance, when I wrote the book Finish, I wasn't good at finishing and I wanted to be better. I was a chronic starter, but not a consistent finisher. So I had a personal connection. Second thing, people came up to me and said, hey, I liked your book Start because I wrote this book about starting goals. But they said, no offense, I've never had a problem starting. I can start 1,000 things tomorrow. I have 100 GoDaddy URLs registered. I could start today. How do I finish? So there was a need. Third thing was I went to Amazon, a marketplace, and I Googled finish. And the only thing that came up was dishwasher detergent. We as a culture celebrate the beginning of goals and we ignore the finish. And so I had the Venn diagram and I could go, and you got to have all three, because say you have a personal connection, nobody's serving it in the market, but nobody really needs it. That's a hobby. Like, I love that you're into ferrets, but nobody needs a ton of resources around ferrets. It's not a huge market. Say you have tremendous, you notice a need, you notice a market, but you're not personally connected to it. You've just created a day job for yourself.
Right.
You might make money. You're not going to enjoy it. And then, you know, say that you have a passion, people need it, but the market's too full. That's a cake pop. If you told me today, I'm doing this new thing called cake pops. I'd go, dude, I got bad news. They're already at Starbucks. Like, if it's already at Starbucks, you're 10 years too late on the idea.
Yeah.
So for anybody who's got an idea, you look for those three things. That's the Venn diagram. And if you can find those, that'll change everything. For my book soundtrack, same thing, because I'm just taking ideas and I'm figuring out how to make them into products, into books, into courses, into speeches. I was an overthinker. Changed my life learning how to think positive thoughts. I can be a writer. I can be a speaker. We asked 10,000 people if they struggle with overthinking. 99.5% of people said yes. If you ever stumble across an idea that 99.5% of people raise their hand for, do that idea. Third thing, I go to the marketplace. Most books and resources about overthinking said, stop it, stop it, stop it. And my thought was, why would I turn off this amazing thinking machine? What if I just fed it with good thoughts? My opinion was, if I can worry, I can wonder. If I can doubt, I can dominate. If I can spin, I can soar. This brain can do some amazing things. So anybody with an idea, those are the first three things you look for.
I love it. It reminds me of that kind of, not the flywheel, but the three circles in Good to Great. You know, one circle is passion, one circle is skill, the other circle is money. And it's like, you know, when all three of those things combined, you can make a lot of money doing it.
Totally.
And, you know, I think for, you know, a guy like you, we were talking off camera. You're like, yeah, you know, I don't have inventory. I don't really have that many employees. Like, it's just, you know, I've found a way to take my ideas and make money from them. Mm-hmm. And for you, it's, you know, through you putting your ideas into books and making money that way, through using your ideas to speak in public.
It's channels. I have multiple faucets. I always tell entrepreneurs that want to be idea entrepreneurs, you need 7 different faucets so that when 4 of them get turned off outside of your control, you've got 3 others going and you've got the time to start some new ones. So last March, it's March of 2020. I've got the best year of public speaking I've ever had in my entire life lined up. It's going to be an amazing year. And then COVID hits. And all of a sudden, every gig either gets canceled, pushed aside or flipped to virtual. And so I have to figure out, okay, what am I going to do now? And so that's when I start experimenting. I go, okay, I'm going to do a podcast. So I start a podcast called All It Takes Is a Goal. Because I go, okay, well, let me figure out something else. I start doing more on YouTube. I start doing challenges. I start doing courses. I take that core idea, which I had been expressing through speeches, and say, what are some other ways to express it? What are some other ways to serve people with it in other markets that I haven't tested yet? And what I taught myself is, okay, I've got a choice. I can pine or I can plan. I can pine for the old way. Oh, this would have been an amazing year for except for COVID. I can whine. I can be depressed. I can be whatever. Or I can plan. I can go, okay, this is where we are. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this? What, you know? And I kept telling people, you know, a crisis is an invitation to innovation. And it's an invitation to innovation. You might not have pushed that soon or that fast, but here it is. And you get the choice of whether to take it or not. And so that's what I did. And so I always tell people, if you have an idea, you figure out, how does this serve people? How does this help people? Why would somebody be interested in this? How do I get that to them in a way that's going to make it easier for them to understand it? And you have that across 6 or 7 different verticals, so that when one goes hot or cold, you're good. Like, you, I had a great year last year. Like, the business had a great year last year. And somebody on the outside might go, dude, 70% of your revenue in March was public speaking. How did you end up with a great year? I ended up because we were able to figure out, okay, well, these other faucets are going, let's do some other stuff. So that's how I look at taking ideas and turning them into income.
Yeah, no, I love that. And the same thing happened for me. You know, I didn't have YouTube, didn't have TikTok, didn't have a podcast, didn't have any of these things. And because of a crisis, I looked at it and I said, you know, what are some other, I didn't call them this, but what are some other faucets? Yeah. What can I start doing? And I didn't realize that I had these skills and that people wanted them. Mm-hmm. And eventually,
there was an audience waiting for it.
There was. Yeah. And I did not know until the crisis hit. And I'm thankful it did for me, because it's allowed us to do so many new things now and serve so many more people, but create new services. And
and when the stuff that got paused comes back, you have an even stronger foundation.
Yeah.
Like, you've got all these other things that you've built new, and then that other thing comes back, and now you're twice, triple, quadruple as strong as you were before. And so that, to me, is what's fun about being hungry about it, figuring it out. But the challenge is always, I interviewed Chuck Liddell's trainer, this guy, Pit John is his name. And he said, there's two things I can't teach. He said, he trained Chuck Liddell for 15 years. He said, I can't teach chin and I can't teach heart. He said, if your chin is physically wired where there's a nerve close to the surface and you get knocked out, I can't change that. He said, and I can't force heart on you. You have, like, I can put fuel on it. I can encourage it. I can pull it out of you. But it, like he said, when Chuck would get hit in the face, he'd get excited. He would go, oh my God. Like Mike Tyson says, you know, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. Chuck Liddell will get more excited because that's his heart. So I think that's some of the challenge too, is you as an entrepreneur have to figure out, which of these things is lighting up my heart? And you can tell when an entrepreneur goes, oh, this is something that I'm interested in, I'm excited about, because then you'll do all the difficult things. If you want to figure out if you're in the right entrepreneurial space, measure the amount of stuff that you're willing to do that you normally wouldn't do. Like, again, I'll take all the delayed flights. I'll take the flight, you know, I get canceled and I'm in Minneapolis and I have to sleep at a La Quinta at 4 a.m. and then get up for a 6 a.m. Like, I'll do all the hard things for the joy of doing those small, fun things that I love. And so you look at your life and go, okay, where am I willing to do that? You know, book signings. People go, when do you know you've arrived? And I always say, you don't. Like, you have moments where, like, I'll take pictures of book signings that there'll be 4 people at. And people go, like, oh, it's so brave. It's not brave. I just want you to know to keep going. That, like, whether you've hit the New York Times list, whether you've done something successful, you're going to have some moments where your ego takes a hit. And those don't end, because you go into new markets. And so that's what I try to do with the people that follow me, the people that I get to encourage, is when you find something you love, you're going to do those moments. And the moments don't end. You just get stronger.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, man. And it's funny, because we're in a society and an economy where ideas can make a lot of freaking money, man. Like, when I first saw what these YouTubers were making, I was like, oh my gosh, like, they don't even have employees. They don't have, they're literally just speaking. They're just telling people their ideas. Yeah. And, you know, I'm like, man, I got to get on that side of the game, because this idea thing is crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at content creators, most of them are, you know, making videos and doing sponsors, and that's typically how they're making a living. Mm-hmm. But from what I see from you is I don't want to call it the old school way of making a living, but like, man, you went the route of writing books, of public speaking. And when you look at the new age of influencers, you know, they're not doing that. I'm not going out there trying to go get public speaking gigs and everything, but you know, you told me before this that you're getting paid $30,000 to go speak for an hour. And once again, we talk about reward, and I'm like, huh, that sounds pretty good.
Well, and here's the thing. I love it. Here's the trick. Here's what, you know, everybody needs to know. There's two ways to love what you do for a living. Number one, find something you love so much you do it for free. Number two, get so good at it that people pay you a lot of money. Yeah. Some people overfocus on the first one, and then they don't get to do it for very long. Right. They find something they love, they do for free, but they don't do the second part. So once you do that, I mean, I got paid $800 to fly across, you know, my first couple gigs. I did a bunch of free gigs because I wasn't good enough to get paid. I had to, you know, earn my way up. And so for me, that's how I kind of look at this is, okay, I love doing it. I want to get better. I want to super serve audiences. I want them to feel like they got a value. Like I've crushed it so hard that they go, oh my gosh, that was really helpful.
Yeah.
And so that, but I guess, I mean, I don't know if I think about it like old school. I still think it comes down to serving people and also going, where is it crowded? Where is it not? There's certain spots that are really crowded where you go, wow, there's a lot of people already in there. What, you know, what's a spot that's not as crowded that fits my skill sets that I actually enjoy doing? Yeah. There's a lot of authors that hate public speaking and they're amazing alone writing in a cave.
Right.
That's not me. I love it. Like they have to drag me off the stage. And so once I realized that, I was like, oh, okay, if the average author doesn't like public speaking, I'm really going to figure out.
I got my own niche.
Yeah, I've got my own niche. And then humor. Like a lot of my stuff is humor based because a lot of other, like I'm never going to out research Jim Collins. Like I'm not.
Yeah.
But I know that like I can bring humor in a way that
you can
like,
be a better speaker than
and like change the audience that way. And so you figure out your niche and you kind of land in it and you enjoy it. And so, yeah, I feel like I have a dream job. I can't believe I get to do this. And then when people say, hey, how do I do it? I can't wait to give them some advice on that.
Yeah.
Like, because I still think, I was talking to somebody the other day, one of the best pickleball players in the world. Pickleball is a successful sport right now. And I said, well, where's the money in pickleball? Because I was curious from an entrepreneur standpoint. And he goes, well, it's not in sponsorships because the major brands aren't in it yet. Fila's barely in it, but Nike's not in pickleball. Reebok's not in pickleball. So I said, okay, well, is it in prize money for tournaments? He said, no, because there's not a unified tournament yet or like a unified league yet. I said, well, where's the money? He said, it's in lessons. It's in teaching other people how to be great at it. People will do, you know, these resort weekends in Steamboat Springs to learn how to play pickleball. So I still think so much of what we get to do is in the teaching other people how to do it.
Yeah.
And going, I found this joy. I think if you're into it too, like, let me show, it took me 10 years. I've done, you know, 7 books, 12 years of writing. Let me save you 4 years.
Yeah.
Or let me save you 3 years. Here's what I learned.
Yeah. No, I think the learning space is going to explode just with virtual learning. Like, man, back in the day, you know, even 10 years ago, it's not like you could go learn from me how to flip houses, right? Mm-hmm. I wasn't accessible. Well, yeah, I wasn't doing it. But guys like me weren't accessible on YouTube, putting out content, being freely available. Like, dude, if you want to reach me, I ain't hard to find.
Yeah.
You go to RyanPineda.com, you can go book a call with my team and find out how to get me. Mm-hmm. But like, other way, back then, it wasn't so freely available. So it's like, I think this information and this learning thing and these idea things are going to be so much easier to sell because of just where society is going. And I think you said it best with niche. You have to figure out where do you fit in all of this, because if you're trying to compete with me and be me, good luck.
Yeah.
There's already me out there.
I'm a terrible Gary Vee. I am the worst Gary Vee. I'm a terrible Lewis Howes. I'm a terrible Ryan. I'm a pretty good John Acuff most days.
Yeah.
But I know what I'm not.
Exactly. And so I see that all the time where people are wanting to emulate someone. There's nothing wrong with
learning.
Yeah. But you're still you, and you got to use your talents, your abilities.
If I started swearing as much as Gary Vee right now, it would feel as fake as could be. That is authentic. We've done events together, and somebody said, I opened up for him, and somebody said it was like watching Coldplay open up for Rage Against the Machine. And I thought that was hilarious, and I'll take that. Viva La Vida is a fantastic song. But yeah, you have to be authentic to your voice, because audiences today, whether it's online, live, can spot fake a million miles away. And if they feel like you're faking it, forget it. You'll have, you know, the shortest career ever.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And I think the main thing is you have to enjoy it, like you said.
Here's what I would say, though, niche. Like, before we leave that, I know we're probably going to run out of time here, but I don't think you have to so hyper niche that you kind of choke out the opportunity. I think give yourself time to develop the niche. There's a lot of people that'll go, before you start, you have to know your exact niche. No, I think the growing is in the going. As you go, you grow and learn and go, okay, this is my spot. I mean, for me, somebody asked me the other day, they said, I want to do a personal brand. And I said, well, number one, why? What's your goal with it? Like, you shouldn't just have a personal brand to have a personal brand. It's a terrible hobby. And I said, I've had multiple. I had my first book, which was a satire about faith, about Christianity, called Stuff Christians Like. So I kind of had the funny Christian guy. And then I started to work for Dave Ramsey. And I had part of my brand was related to spending 3 years with his brand. There's financial peace, all that.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That's where I got my kind of PhD in personal branding. And then I started my own business, and it was kind of miscellaneous. I was like, am I going to do parenting? Am I going to try this? And then over the years, it's really honed down into I love goals. Like, I think a goal is the fastest path between where you are today and where you want to be tomorrow. And starting is fun, but the future belongs to finishers. So now I know. But if I had said to 2008 John, who's writing advertising copy for Auto Trader, you got to figure out your micro niche before you start, garbage advice. So I would say niche as you go, but don't make niche a prerequisite to starting. You won't know your niche until you're in the middle of your niche and you go, oh, that ain't my niche.
Yeah.
This feels right. That feels really wrong. This feels better. That's how I think about niche.
Yeah, and I'll say, for me personally, I'm building my personal brand as I go, right?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know what I wanted my message to be. I've just simply been being myself, and the message is being received in multiple ways, but I'm getting consistent feedback from my audience of like, hey, this is why I follow you over this guy. This is what makes you different. And I've been learning the niche, and it's funny because I sat down with my team yesterday and we were like, okay, you know, I run a ton of different businesses and it's very hard to promote them all at this point, right? So it's like, okay, instead of sending everyone to individual websites and different things, let's just send everyone to RyanPineda.com, okay? But what is RyanPineda.com's slogan or mission statement or, you know, USP, unique selling proposition? Like, what will, if somebody's never heard my stuff, what am I going to tell them? And, you know, I've been known for real estate investing. That's what's, you know, built my businesses to where they are today. But like, do I consider myself this guy who's the real estate investing guy who will teach you how to flip houses? I mean, sure, like, I'm good at it, but we haven't talked about it once on this. Like, you know, that's not what I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about helping people build businesses, but really, what people have told me and what I've realized too is like, I'm more passionate about helping people build wealth and also still have freedom to do everything else in their life while they build it, you know? Because the typical message that Gary Vee and these other guys have is, dude, you got to grind it out for the next 10 years, just freaking eat dirt, you know, put in the work, and the future will thank you. And, you know, build a business that way. Whereas I'm like, nah, dude, you can be a millionaire not working crazy hours, you know, spending time with your family, you know, not ignoring your faith, having a healthy life.
If I lose my family but gain a business, I've that's a terrible trade-off for me. Like, it's just not worth it.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's like, that's just who I am and what I've always believed. Because people are like, well, weren't you grinding when you were first doing it? I'm like, no, I've never worked weekends. Like, I just never wanted to do it and I chose not to. And even though I lose out on money, I don't care. I just don't want to do it.
Well, I just keep thinking to myself, the richest person in the room is the person who's not hurried.
Yeah.
And I know I've met billionaires who were stressed and hurried and had 2 seconds. I've met thousandaires who felt confident and had time to listen to a new idea or had time to help somebody. It's so fascinating, you know, what we end up valuing. But yeah, I mean, that's where we overlap, is that I'm the same way, that, you know, I've got 2 teenage daughters that I want to know me, that I want to, you know, have relationship with and pour into, and not, you know, I remember writing a long time ago that I've never met a 13-year-old who said, my dad wasn't around for the first 13 years of life because he was grinding and building something, but now I have a cool bike. So it was all a good trade-off. Like, I have a really nice mountain bike. So it was a good trade-off. Like, that's not how kids think. And so I always try to go, okay, I want to do my best because I want to show my kids that they can have a passionate career that they get paid well for. Like, I want to show them that example, but I don't want to show them at the expense of having a relationship with them.
Right. And that's what I think my main message is going to be to you know, entrepreneurs and people, it's just like, dude, there are ways to build your business and be extremely wealthy, extremely successful without putting in all this time. There are ways to do it. And, you know, you got to be creative to get there.
Well, and being faithful to the talents you've been given. Because everybody, I mean, that's what everybody wants, is that you want to know you gave it your all. Like, you did the best with what you were given. And there's ways to do that without going to burnout, without having your life fall apart. You know, I don't accept that to be at a certain level, you have to have your life fall apart on some level. I just, that doesn't sound very fun to me.
No, I'm with you, dude. Well, dude, it's been a lot of fun, you know, chatting with you, dude.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to do it.
The audience got a ton of value. Where can people find out more about you?
My podcast is All It Takes Is a Goal. If you were going to listen to one episode, I'd say Greg Sankey, who is the SEC commissioner, who led the SEC through COVID and the rest of the sports world, watched them to see what they were going to do. And so that was a really fun episode. I'm at acuff.me, acuff.me. And then you can read the first chapter of Soundtracks at soundtracksbook.com for free.
That's awesome, bro. Well, dude, it's been a lot of fun. Guys, if you enjoyed this episode, do me a favor, if you're on YouTube, go hit that like button. Make sure you're subscribed. If you're on Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star review. We'll catch you on the next one. Peace.
Thanks for watching The Ryan Pineda Show. If you want to work with me, head over to ryanpineda.com. You can find my courses, coaching programs, and upcoming events. We also have free resources you can download, so head over to ryanpineda.com.